Good to see you guys today. Well, as we've been going through the book of 1 Samuel, it's the story of King Saul and then transitions into David as his life relates to King Saul. The last few weeks, we've been on an interesting journey. In chapter 19, we got a close look at what a dysfunctional family looks like. In the family of Saul. David married into this family and then figured out, whoa, this is weird. An unhealthy, dysfunctional family usually has one person who's driving everything. And they are egotistical, power hungry, they're cruel and selfish, angry, jealous, and everyone else in the family has to adjust to that person. And that was Saul's family. And David married into that family. And he's like, whoa, what is going on? So then we saw in chapter 20, though, the most important thing for somebody who finds themselves living in dysfunction is that they figure out how to have a real friend. And so we saw in chapter 20 the healing power of just knowing that you're not alone. You have somebody who understands the situation, in this case, Jonathan. And it's like, no matter what else happens, man, we're in this together. And that's really important for anyone who grows up in dysfunction. But last week we saw David as he began to run for his life. And he came to the tabernacle and he had to make some tough decisions. He lied to the priest. The priest gave him bread that only the priests are supposed to eat. And he served it to him and his guys. And then he went to Gath to try to escape to the Philistines and then had to act like he was crazy in order to get himself out of Gath. But we saw as we looked at that chapter that there's nothing in the text that says he was wrong about any of this. But more importantly, when Jesus commented on it, he says, David did the right thing. In fact, Jesus said, what I am doing is like what he did. And so we realize that the spirit of the law, your heart, is much more important than whether or not you follow rules, because rules will always have exceptions. Rules are beneficial. They're usually dependable. But if you don't have the spirit, you don't know when you're in a situation where the rules don't apply to this particular case. But now David's out and on the run. As we come to chapter 22. And so let's just dive right into it. What you will see now, David is going to be living in the wilderness for the next 10 plus years. He's going to be out there on the run living in the wilderness. And I've entitled this message, Wilderness Survival, because as we study David in these ensuing chapters, we see how you can stay alive when you're in the wilderness. And that's good to understand, especially if you have the self-awareness to realize we too are in the wilderness. Sorry, we are not the ones who are in charge. We're not running things. We're not the best and the brightest. We live in a society where the people who are in control don't care about us, don't value what we value at all. They are in it for themselves. And here we are as renegades and you know, refugees just trying to survive. And if you don't understand that, you're delusional, because that's the truth and that's the way it is. And therefore, when we read these stories, the Bible gives us these stories so that we can learn how to survive in the wilderness that we live in. There was the old Christian song, "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through." That's David. So, chapter 22. David, therefore, departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. We're not sure exactly where it is, but it's probably up north a little bit where near where he had defeated Goliath. That's what most scholars believe. But his brother and all his father's house heard it, and they went down there. And again, down, you know, means coming away from Jerusalem, so it actually, we would say they went up there, went down there to him. Now, It's weird that his family came to him. Like, where have they been? You don't see them in his story except when they are disrespecting him, when they are discounting him, when they are accusing him. As much as Saul's family was dysfunctional, so was David's. I mean, remember, it's his brothers that had nothing but bad to say about him. It's his dad who, when Samuel came and said, "Oh, I want to meet all your sons," he doesn't even bother inviting David. And after Samuel goes through each of the brothers, and he's like, "Don't you have another son?" And he goes, "Well, not really. Well, sorry. I mean, yeah, a little redhead who's out in the field tending the sheep." He doesn't even name him. "Bring him here. Yeah, he's the one I'm going to anoint." So David grew up not being that tight with his family. And in fact, for the rest of his story, you don't see him being really tight with his family. But they came out here to him. And we do see interwoven through his story, some of them show up doing different things, but they aren't his like most trusted officers or anything. They're just there. So it's weird that his family came out there to him. We'll talk about that in a bit. But they came. And then look, he got some other guys following him too. Everyone who was in distress, meaning they were pinched in, people who were just like completely, you know, flattened, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented, that's two Hebrew words, the first meaning bitter and the other nefesh meaning soul. So all the people who were crushed, broke and miserable and cranky gathered to him. I'm sure he's like, "I wonder if anybody's going to come out here in the wilderness and side with me. My family? Great. All the losers from Israel? Great. These are my merry men." But they came. And he became captain over them. Somebody had to do it. And there were about 400 men with him at this time. It says, so he became captain, because it's like, none of them were going to be leading anybody to do anything. So he's like, okay, this is what I got. Okay, I'm the captain. Then David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab — Moab was another country that really Israel hadn't got along that great with Moab — "Please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for them." So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. So he takes his parents and puts them in a Moabite retirement center. And I mean, he couldn't take them to some Jewish place. Saul would probably use them against him. Why Moab? Well, remember, his dad, Jesse, was the grandson of one of the most famous Moabites, Ruth. Ruth from the book of Ruth, who was a Moabitess who married, you know, Boaz, a Jew. So for the Jews, their connection with Moab went through David's family. And for David, the like, Moabites are like our distant relatives, and they seem safe. So I think the Moabites probably liked the family of Jesse, because it's like, you're part us. We spit in a bottle and sent it in, and they said, "Hey, you're related to us." So he takes them there so that they will be safe. And then the prophet Gad, a prophet that shows up out of nowhere, obviously a prophet who was broke and depressed, said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go to the land of Judah." So David departed and went into the forest of Herath. So he gets a word from the Lord that says, "I know you feel safe here. You're in a cave. This would seem like a good place to hide out. But this is a perfect place for a target. And so you need to be on the move. You need to be going somewhere where there are trees and forests, and you're going to be on the run for a while, over 10 years. So just being in the cave all the time is going to make you a sitting duck." So he heads off and heads down into the area of Judah, where he would be moving around in order to survive the wilderness. So in verse 6, Saul heard David had some guys, and they were out there. And Saul was there in Gibeah, and he had his spear, his servants were around him. And look at verse 7. Saul starts to lecture his own servants, who were the guys closest to him were Benjamites, because he was from the tribe of Benjamin. And he used racism against David, who was from the tribe of Judah, to say, look, this guy, he's Judean. You think he's going to take care of you like I have? I'm one of you. And so he's this Benjamin supremacist. And so he said, look, hear now, you Benjamites. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? He says what big government always says. As far as that goes, this is what big business always says. This is what big church and religion always says. He goes, look at everything I've done for you. I have given you so much. Everything you have, I gave you. And hoping they don't figure out, you gave it to us because you took it all from us. You taxed us to death, and then you throw us a bone, and we're supposed to be indebted to you? But that's the deception. Saul didn't give them anything, but he took from them, as God said he would do, and then gave some of them back and made them feel like they owe him somehow. Sound familiar? When you get your like, whoa, I got a little tax rebate. Where do you think they got that? You think the congressmen and you think they all chipped in for you? They took your money and gave you a little bit of it back. Well, that's what he's doing. But he goes, listen, I have a bone to pick with you guys. All of you have conspired against me. You guys are all guilty. There's no one who told me, revealed to me, that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse, and there's not one of you who is sorry for me, poor me, or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day. He goes, how come none of you told me that my son is fighting against me, that he's the one that actually made David turn on me, and now they're getting ready to try to overthrow me, and you guys knew it, and nobody said anything? These are the rantings of a lunatic, and they didn't believe it, but this is what power does. It's one of the ways that power corrupts you, is it makes you believe delusional things. And so the anger, and it's like, this is what happens when a dysfunctional person doesn't get exactly what they want. They play that card. They play the ranting, and you're at fault. And you've probably seen this in dysfunctional families that you know or that you've been a part of. Like somehow all of a sudden, yeah, I don't get what I want. It's all your fault. How could you do this to poor little me? So he said, none of you even told me what was going on. And Doeg, the Edomite, remember him before when David was there at the tabernacle getting food? It said Doeg was there on business for Saul. Well, now he spoke up. He said, I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. Now, there isn't anything in the text that said that Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him, like he gave him advice. He couldn't have done that because David lied to Ahimelech. Ahimelech thought that David was working for Saul. But Doeg hadn't told Saul right away about seeing David there because he thought, maybe David is on a secret mission for Saul and I'll look really stupid if I divulge, you know, it looks like loose lips sink ships. But now that he knew that Saul was after David, then he goes, oh, by the way, I saw him with Ahimelech, and Ahimelech, you know, was like probably praying over him, gave him a bunch of food, gave him Goliath's sword. So the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all of his father's house, all the priests who were there in Nob. And they came to the king, and Ahimelech doesn't know anything. He's just done David a favor on behalf of Saul. Saul said, hear now, son of Ahitub. He goes, yeah. Here I am. Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me? you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him. You got God on his side, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day. Is that true? Of course not. David's not lying in wait trying to destroy Saul. He's running for his life from Saul. But he confronts the priest and is like, you did this. You were involved in this. And the priest is like, what? And so he said, no, think about it. Who among all your servants is as faithful as David, who's the king's son-in-law, by the way, who goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house? He's like, David, that is your son-in-law who lays his life on the line for you all the time? That David? Is that who you're talking about? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? No. Far be it from me, let not the king impute anything to his servant or to any in the house of my father, for your servant knew nothing of all this, little or much. I knew nothing about what you're talking about. But once you get somebody like Saul on a roll, he's not going to hear this. He just knows what he thinks he knows. And so the king says, you shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. Then the king said to the guards who stood about him, turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell it to me. But the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. Amazing. They had enough reverence that they're like, we work for you and you're the king, but there's a line that we won't cross. And like killing a bunch of priests for no reason because you're crazy, we're not going to do it. And so Saul just, okay, fine. He said to Doeg, you kill the priests. Doeg had no, he probably wasn't even a follower of the God of Israel. The priests mean nothing to him. So he turned and struck the priests and killed on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. He wiped out 85 priests. And then he goes to the city. This was a bonus. Saul didn't even tell him to do this. He went and struck with the edge of the sword men and women, children, nursing infants, oxen, donkeys, sheep, with the edge of the sword. I mean, just total overkill, hacking everyone. And Saul, I guess, looked at him and thought, my kind of guy. Actually not, because like Doeg never shows up in the story again. So I think Saul's like, okay, next time maybe I don't pick a psychopath to do what I want him to do. There's only room in this kingdom for one psychopath. That would be me. So one of the sons of Ahimelech in verse 20, named Abiathar, escaped. Out of all the priests that were there, one escaped. And he ran to David, because he's like, I don't know who else I can talk to. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priests. Interesting that, well, first David said to Abiathar, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there. I saw that weasel, and I thought, this guy can't be trusted. But instead of saying, Saul is really evil, look what he says. I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. The buck stops with me. I did what I thought I needed to do, but I'm taking responsibility for this. So stay with me. Do not fear, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. But with me, you shall be safe. He goes, you stay with us. You have a place. You have a safe place. I will give my life for you. We can be together. You can become Friar Tuck in my Merry Men. And so there he's got his team put together and they're in the wilderness. And they're learning how to survive together. And that's kind of the pivot of chapter 22, is now we're in the wilderness. Several things jump out at me in this passage that I think are helpful for us when we are trying to survive in the wilderness, if in fact you have the clarity to recognize that you are in fact in the wilderness. First of all, that whole introduction where he had his family come. And then he actually took his parents and put them in a safe place. That's sort of an odd thing to do, because I don't think he felt like he could really trust his family. His brothers never became like generals under him or anything, but they're his family. His parents, he's like, I'm going to put you in a safe place. Why was that so important? See, David, living in the wilderness, he needed to travel light. So you would think getting his family out of the way would have been order number one. But order number one is to make peace with his family and to forgive them. Everything they had done against him, he wipes away in this moment of desperation by saying, you know, I am going to honor my father and mother because the 10 commandments say that you should do this. The fifth commandment, honor your father and mother, and that'll help you live longer. I need something that will help me live longer, so I'm going to honor my father and mother. It isn't a conditional thing. It isn't like honor them if they are honorable. They weren't that honorable. He honored them because they were his parents. But also, the family ends up being the first group of people, usually, that you need to forgive because you have reasons. They know you too well. You know them too well. And so often, our bitterness and our resentment and our lack of forgiveness connects in some way, often, to our families. So David didn't forgive them for their benefit, because they never came out and goes, hey, David, we feel really bad for the way we treated you. Will you forgive us? No. They came out there probably because they were afraid they were going to be targets. And so they're like, oh, we got to get out of here. But you don't ever forgive people for their benefit. You forgive people for your benefit, because you are on a survival mission. And you can't afford to carry a bunch of extra baggage. And when I forgive someone who has hurt me, it relieves me of that burden. I can't afford to have resentment against anyone controlling me. So when I forgive, I take control of my life back by saying, well, the way you've treated me isn't going to define who I am. And so this is really important, because it lightens the load that you carry. And if you're going to travel light, you have to let go of whatever it is that's still hanging in there. I know people who are still absolutely crippled by people who hurt them who aren't even alive anymore, by parents or friends or bosses or a church or whatever hurt you. And you can never come to terms with just going, you know what? Wipe it out. It's fine. It is what it is. I have a race to run, and I can't carry a bunch of extra baggage with me. I have a responsibility to survive in this wilderness. And so it's no time to carry resentment. I've got to get that out of my head so that I can be fully flexible in doing what I need to do and that which is most important. So, you know, I think that's where he starts. It's kind of like what Joseph did. Remember, I mean, talk about being treated badly by your family. His brothers sold him into slavery to Egypt. I mean, first they threw him in a ditch, beat him up, then put his blood on his, took his coat, got blood on it, and told his dad that he had been killed by some animal. Then they sold him into slavery, and then he's in prison in Egypt for years, and then he works his way up, and he's finally got into a position of authority in Egypt, and now his family needs him. He's like, okay, come on up, I'll take care of you. And his brothers were so nervous, because they thought, maybe he's being nice to us because of dad, but dad's not looking so good. As soon as he dies, Joseph's going to kill us. And he knew they were thinking that, and he called them in and he goes, no, forget it. I'm not going to kill you. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to become who you were, because that would be the ultimate destruction of who I am. So you're going to be fine. I don't carry what you did as a burden. I see it as a blessing. God used it. You meant it for evil, he said, but God meant it for good, letting it go. I want to encourage you, whatever it is right now that's holding you back and dragging you down, wherever you need to make peace with your past, to intentionally forgive anyone who has ever hurt you, you don't let it go because they didn't mean it. They meant it. People are jerks because they actually think they're doing the right thing. So you can't expect them to all of a sudden change. But you can decide, I'm just letting go of this. I am forgiving. I am pushing it aside and saying, I'm not going to deal with that anymore. It's fine. I can't carry it. I have to travel light. It's such an important thing to do. Whoever it is that injured you, they don't deserve forgiveness, maybe. You deserve forgiveness. And you're the only one who can really show that to yourself. And so he did that, and it's a great example of that. But how about this group of guys? I mean, yeah, he's got the one priest who's a fast runner and got away. But then it's all the people who are in distress, all the people who are broke, everyone who has bitter souls. They're miserable. And he's like, so, this is my team now. He's used to being the captain over crack troops, those who are the elite of the elite, and he would lead them. And now he finds himself surrounded by a bunch of losers, and he's in the wilderness. Maybe you can relate. You know, at different times in your life, you look around like, how come like normal people don't ever befriend me? You know, and maybe you're more one of these than you recognize. But how could he possibly develop these guys into an army? Because that was his job, and that's what he would ultimately do. And it was pretty amazing, some of the things they were able to do, because David was an amazing teacher. He was a warrior of warriors. There are some advantages, actually, in the potential that is in guys like this. People who life has kind of beat them up, their has-beens, they're worn out, they're broke. See, people like that have low expectations. They already think that life hates them. So anything that's better than what they had looks good. And that's not so bad. They don't expect a whole lot. They have the attitude that, well, and Bob Dylan said in Like a Rolling Stone, when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. People who think they have something to lose are desperate to protect it. People who think they have nothing to lose, now it's just about survival. Guys like that have some great potential. And they also will tend to be teachable. They're like, you know what? I am a complete failure. So I'm open to suggestions as to how I might live life a little differently. But also, the toughest people are almost never young, strong, healthy people. You know, in my life, I've seen, you know, more than my share of fights. And often you see, and a lot of these were at ball games and other, you know, and then there are some places you just shouldn't be, but it's just the way it was. But I've seen a lot of fights with an old guy and a young guy. And the young guy's ripped. He's got beach muscles. He's like, and he's a big talker. The old guy, man, he looks like he's been knocked around his whole life. And bet on the old guy in a fight every single time. You know why? That guy that's buffed, he gets freaked out if he just gets hit in the face, and he's afraid his looks are destroyed. He's never even seen or tasted his own blood. The old guy is like, what, am I going to get uglier? It's okay. You hit an old guy in the face, he keeps coming at you. You know, he gets hurt. He's like, I hurt every day when I get out of bed. That's nothing new. So if you're putting together a ragtag bunch of troops, you could do worse than a bunch of people with nothing to lose. You can do worse with scrappy people who've been beat up, But now they realize, I'm now fighting for survival. I'm not fighting for a trophy. I'm not fighting to say we won. I'm not fighting to help somebody else get something they want. It's like my back is against a wall and I'm going to bring it. And if I go down, I'm going down fighting. And that was this crew. All they needed ultimately was a leader. People like this whose life has really shredded them, they're looking for a leader. And if you find yourself in a group like this, then say, I wonder if I could lead these people. Or find the leader in the group and follow and support and pray for that leader. That is a key to surviving in the wilderness, is recognizing that we can do this with whatever we have. It may not look ideal, but boy, we're scrappy. And I think that we are able to do something. At least we're going to make it painful and miserable for someone to try to take us down. And it's a huge key in the wilderness. Like, no rules, no order, no negotiations. It's a fight to the death. And, you know, when I got into this thing, it was because I really wanted to die. So now, I'm willing to fight. And that was these guys. And you're going to see as we continue going through this book, it's amazing what they were able to do because they had that fighting spirit that said, we aren't the best, we aren't the biggest, we're not the strongest, but we don't quit. We're going to battle this and we're going to do everything we can or we'll go down trying. And so, you know, that's an important part of this. And it is for us as well. The kind of people that will have your back, the kind of people that you can always count on in life, aren't the people that you might expect. They aren't the people that you have these nice, neat, little, perfect relationships with. There are going to be times in your life when you go, you know what? The people that are hanging around me now, none of these people were the ones that I would have chosen. But like, here we are, we're all together. And I start thinking, where'd all these losers come from? And then I go, that's what they're saying about me too. Okay, that's where we are. We're in the wilderness. What are we going to do? How tough are we really willing to be? Now, the other thing that we'll see with these guys is that they aren't a bunch of babies. They cry, just like David, but they are not whining about their circumstances. See, when you're in the wilderness, you have to accept this is the wilderness. I am a minority. The system is working against me. I'm not expecting the government to help me. I'm not expecting fair play to work out. I'm expecting that I am a renegade. So I better quit being a baby and I need to start battling like it matters. I believe, well, if you study history, you find out the people who survive are the people who are tough. That's the way it is. I was reading this week some original writings from people in the 1800s after the Civil War, when people were moving west, and what life was like in the wagon trains. It wasn't like the clean, you know, westerns that we watch, man. People were dying. More people died being run over by wagon trains than died from Indians killing them. And sorry, Native Americans. No, Indians. But disease was rampant. It was ugly. It was a mess. I read about this one guy who, they stayed in a hotel in Denver. And in the hotel, you paid, and there was a room with 8 beds. And there were 2 people to a bed. So you're in a bed with a stranger with a bunch of other strangers in the room. And there are bugs all over the place gnawing away at you. And they finally pooled their money and bought a lamb chop and threw it in the middle of the floor so the bugs would go after the lamb chop and they could get a little sleep. That's what built the West. Now, the builder generation, the people that were around during the Depression and during, you know, World War II and all that, they did without, and they were happy to. They put limits on us. They said, you can't have this product or that one. And everyone binded together for the sake of our country, because that needed to happen. And that created a generation of really powerful people who built everything that we have. The problem with today is that we are treating people like they're babies, like they aren't capable of anything. We are trying to say, oh, somebody was mean to you? Well, we will make up for that. It's time for us to make it right. And okay, I get it. You've been treated badly, I get it. But you can decide. When you're treated badly, what kind of a person does that make you? Or do you just want somebody to fix it for you so you're a little baby? Look at Afghanistan, as horrible as that is. For 20 years, we are putting certain people into power. And it was a great place for them to live as long as we're willing to be there. But when we leave, they didn't really know how to fight for themselves. Same thing happened in Vietnam. The same thing happens everywhere that we send our power. You do things for people, and they don't know how to do it for themselves. I met a guy one time who, he was brilliant. He was a professor. And he had graduated from Harvard, had a PhD from Harvard. And he told me, he goes, you know, I was diagnosed as being learning disabled and dyslexic. When I was a little kid, I was in special programs until eighth grade. And I go, wow, what happened? And I expected him to say, well, they had special programs for me. He goes, they had special programs and didn't do a thing for me. He said, I had a junior high teacher who pulled me aside and he goes, I'm learning disabled just like you are. And I'm going to tell you something. The world isn't going to go special on you. You are going to have to fight three times as hard as everyone else, maybe to get B's and C's, but you put out that effort and you can achieve. Can you imagine somebody even telling some poor special student that today? No, it'd be like, that's cruel. We need to accommodate. We are in the wilderness. And I don't know how many ways I can say this. Quit being a baby. Quit being such a wuss that you think every time you suffer, it's somebody else's problem and they need to fix it. We are in this wilderness to survive. You survive by being tough. I don't care who you are and what you do. David would have thrown you out in an instant if you started whining and asking him to do something for you. He would have said, well, yep, that's the way it is. You got to toughen up. You know, talk about, you know, somebody who's accommodated, like compare Colin Kaepernick, for instance, to Jackie Robinson. You know, sometimes the greatest things you can do are when people, you know, are against you. And then you suck it up anyway, and you deal with it, and you accomplish something, and you feel like you've, okay, I'll quit ranting on this. Here's the thing, though. Don't expect power to change. Saul never changed. Don't think that it's some culture war where if we get enough people together, we can take over. If we get the right candidate in here, then we can actually get the victory. That's not the way it works in the wilderness. David never tried to defeat Saul. He knew that God would eventually. What he tried to do is stay alive and do the best he could where he was in the wilderness. No culture war for him. It would have been foolish. He couldn't have gone against Saul and won. And if he had, he would have been killing God's anointed anyway. So in our society, where we keep thinking that the answer is, okay, let's vote this narcissist out and let's vote another narcissist in, we think we're going to change the fact that we're in the wilderness. It doesn't work that way. And the other thing, remember Gad came to him and he goes, you can't stay here in the cave forever. If you're in a cave, it's a good place to build a fort. But now you're a sitting duck. And so he goes, you want to survive? You need to be on the move. Comfort is not your friend. Comfort is your enemy. You need to understand, stay mobile, stay liquid, stay on the move. Because your job is simply to survive and to help the guys with you to survive as well. Not to build a kingdom. Not to build, I mean, there are people who think that you know, if we can get a bunch of churches together and make this massive movement, boy, that sure makes it easy. Boom, you're a target. They blow you up all at once. Fly under the radar. Keep it cool. Do what God's showing you to do, but don't think you're going to win the culture war. You won't. You can't. It's not how it works. You're in the wilderness. Survive. That's what it's about. Now, David was really uncomfortable for over 10 years, you know, living in the wilderness, right? But you know what? Something's amazing, because eventually he would get comfortable. In fact, he built out the city of David. If you've been to Israel, it's an amazing structure of houses and buildings there right next to the Temple Mount, where ultimately Solomon built the temple that David paid for. And he made, in fact, the reason he wanted to build a temple is he felt so bad because his house was so nice. And he's like, oh, that should make God something. But here's the thing. When David got comfortable, his life started going downhill. If he had believed that someday, when I'm king and I'm sitting in the palace, it's going to make all this worthwhile, he found out, actually, if you get what you want, you're going to regret it. It's actually going to be not good at all. When David was in the wilderness, he was incredibly creative. He was incredibly poetic. He had a connection and a relationship with God that was unbelievable. You read through the Psalms and you see some of them seem to have been written when he was a kid taking care of sheep, but the vast majority of the Psalms that David wrote, some of them it even tells us that, were when he was in the wilderness. Being in the wilderness, fighting every day for survival, it makes you really spiritual, because you need him. You need God. It makes you very creative, because you don't have anything else to do. As soon as he became king, he quit writing songs, from what we can tell. Well, there are a couple of exceptions. Psalm 51, when David was king and he stole another guy's wife, got her pregnant, and then had the guy killed, and then he gets confronted, then he wrote Psalm 51. So that brought some creativity out in him. Psalm 3, he wrote when his son, Absalom, rebelled against him, took all of his concubines and everything, and chased him out of Jerusalem. And when David's on the run, he writes the third psalm. But for the most part, his best days were in the wilderness. Maybe some of you have gone through really tough times in your life, and now things are pretty comfortable. I would bet almost anything that you say, those struggles, that was when it was real. That was when I connected with God and I knew he was there, and it was, I thought I'd never get out of that. As soon as I got comfortable, I realized I'm kind of wired for wilderness survival. And David shows us this, and as we continue going through his story, we'll see over and over again that for us, if we think that winning something is going to give us what we want, it may give us exactly the opposite of what we want. If we accept the fact that we're surrounded by a bunch of other weird people and we're in desperate straits often, but boy, surviving is exhilarating. Boy, survival brings out creativity in us. Boy, it draws us closer to God. It's not going to happen if we're a bunch of crybabies. And I'm sorry if I offend you with that characterization. I've been that way myself. I know, I relate to it. But the thing is, do you want to survive or not? Because that's what you need to hear. That's what these guys had to learn. And I hope you're figuring it out. That you whining doesn't help anything. You being strong and growing stronger under resistance, that's something that'll turn you into a real soldier. And you will find that some of the people who have your back are people that you would have thought of as losers before you realized, I need these guys. I need these people. These are my people. Yeah, they're weird. I'm sure I'm weird too. But we're out here together in the wilderness. We understand. And they will be a bigger blessing to you than all of the great success stories that'll throw you a bone. It's just the way it is. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for sharing this story with us and then helping us to recognize this world, it's our wilderness. It's not our home. We're on the run. The people in power, they hate us because they hate you. And that's what you told us would happen. Help us to stop the delusional thinking that somehow we're going to beat those guys. Lord, help us to outlast them by your Spirit. Help us to do those things that allow us to survive as we draw close to you, as you lead us from hideout to hideout, as you help us to wind our way through whatever challenges this world has to offer. And God, I pray that the hard times will make us tougher, will make us stronger, that we will not allow our culture to turn us into a bunch of babies. Thank you that you didn't do that, that you took it full force, that Jesus, you came and experienced everything as we are, yet ultimately at the ultimate injustice, you didn't say anything. You were willing to die. When you could have just talked your way out of it or got a lawyer, you just took it. Lord, help us to learn from that as we share in your sufferings. God, if there's anybody listening today or here who has never really connected with you, they can relate to the wilderness, but they've never connected with the God who meets us in the wilderness. I pray that you would let them know right now that the way they feel isn't weird or stupid. It's really important. And real people will relate to that and connect to that, and you do as well. But help them to know that you, the God of heaven, loves them and will help them survive. So God, please work in the hearts of anyone who needs to come into a relationship with you. We pray. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.